with law and justice back then, you know, it was, I sometimes now these days I forget how it was, but basically like every single day we would get news about like yet another decision, attack on that institution, on this institution, like every day there would be something. Obviously it wasn't at like such an imperial scale as it is with Donald Trump, for example, but that was the kind of vibe. Like every day we would feel like we're just being attacked and attacked and attacked. And when I say we, I mean women, youth, marginalized communities, basically anyone who wasn't part of this like ultra Christian conservative circles, nationalistic circles. And so for many years, it felt like we're constantly on the defense side and constantly trying to like, you know, protest against them. And it was, yeah, in a way, like for me as a young adult, as a, you know, 18-year-old, 20-year-old, like stepping into like the my adult life, I realized that like if we get yet another term of that right-wing government, so the third term, we cannot be sure if that democratic backsliding will just not like complete itself.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Was tun Podcast. Hier sprechen wir ab jetzt wieder einmal im Monat mit Aktivistinnen und Aktivisten darüber, wie wir als Linke nicht nur kämpfen, sondern auch gewinnen können. Wir, das sind Valentin und Inken. Wir interessieren uns für politische Strategie und machen diesen Podcast, um die Diskussion darüber mit euch zu teilen. Es ist jetzt 3 Monate her, seit wir in unsere Podcast-Pause gegangen sind und wir melden uns jetzt mit einem Special zurück. In den nächsten 3 Episoden sprechen wir mit AktivistInnen aus Polen, Israel und Brasilien über linken Aktivismus unter rechtsextremen Regierungen und ihre Erfahrung damit, was es braucht, um die Rechten wieder loszuwerden, nachdem sie einmal in der Macht sind. Seit über einem Jahr wird jetzt nämlich schon darüber geredet, dass die AfD in Sachsen-Anhalt und Mecklenburg-Vorpommern zum ersten Mal die absolute Mehrheit erreichen könnte. Und das hätte natürlich schwerwiegende Folgen für viele Menschen, die dort leben. Gleichzeitig haben Valentin und ich inzwischen eine gewisse Frustration damit entwickelt, gebannt wie das Kaninchen vor der Schlange zu sitzen und nur darüber nachzudenken, ob eine Koalition zwischen CDU und Linken sinnvoll ist, wenn das dann die Faschisten von der Macht fernhält.
Als Bewegungspodcast wollen wir deswegen etwas weitergehen und mit Leuten darüber sprechen, was politisch überhaupt noch möglich ist, wenn Rechtsextreme regieren und wie man sie eben dann auch wieder los wird. Deswegen habe ich für diese Folge mit der polnischen Klimaaktivistin Dominika Lasota gesprochen. Dominika war Teil einer Kampagne, die sich in Polen bei der letzten Parlamentswahl darauf konzentriert hat, die Wahlbeteiligung unter jungen Frauen zu erhöhen. Und hat sich damit gegen die Wiederwahl der ultrarechten Law and Justice Partei engagiert, die hierzulande auch bekannt als PiS-Partei ist. Auf dem neu gegründeten Blog Frontline Notes, den wir euch an dieser Stelle auch ans Herz legen möchten, hat Dominika einen Artikel veröffentlicht, in dem sie ziemlich selbstkritisch beschreibt, dass es naiv gewesen ist, zu denken, dass mit der Wahlniederlage von Law and Justice alles besser werden würde und sie nicht mit den Liberalen gerechnet hätten, die nach den Rechtsextremen kommen.
Bevor es jetzt mit dem Interview losgeht, noch einen Hinweis in eigener Sache. Ab dieser Folge machen Valentin und ich die Interviews im Wechsel alleine, nicht wie bisher gemeinsam. In der Nachbesprechung hört ihr uns dann aber wieder gemeinsam und diesmal erzähle ich dann Valentin, was ich in dem Gespräch besonders spannend fand und ich daraus mitnehme und in der nächsten Folge ist es dann andersrum. Jetzt aber erstmal viel Spaß beim Interview mit Dominika Lasota aus Polen und Valentin.
So I have Dominika Lasota now on our podcast, and I'm very happy that you could make it. Dominika, welcome to Was tun.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me. And I'm always really happy and excited to just chat about what's going on in Poland, but also what's going on in Germany, because even though our countries have such a complex history, if you can say diplomatically, like it's, I think there are some common trends that, it's just fascinating for me to observe how on both sides of the other river, how things are playing out. So yeah, good to hear you.
Great. Before we jump right into the conversation and talk more about how to defeat the far right and what people working against the AfD in Germany can learn from the Polish experience, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit more to our listeners and talk also a little bit about how you started to think about these questions around the far right, because originally, I think your background was more in climate activism, right? So maybe just tell us a little bit how you came to work on these issues.
Sure. So I am 24 years old now. And when I was starting my activism in the climate, in the youth climate movement, I was 17, 18. And I'm saying it because it was... And my parents, my family was never political. I was never meant to be an activist because I was a nerd and very shy. And basically, I just felt like all of this like big, big, scary world and big, big, scary politics is just something that is absolutely beyond my control and influence, especially coming from like a city like this where, you know, it's just so boring and dead all the time. Since I was a teenager and I was, as a nerd, reading all of these things about climate emergency and like the inequalities and basically just like the rise of like undemocratic forces around the world. And in Poland, it was harder and harder not to feel like I had to do something. So that's how I joined like the movement and activism in general. I literally just came to like a local small action in my home city. And then I was like, okay, I may help out with writing some graphics and so on. And I just got really excited to find friends and to just, you know, suddenly find myself surrounded by people who weren't shy, who were nerdy, but who also felt like they have this huge role and purpose and power to show to the rest of Poland. So I got swallowed, and very early on, actually, into like my activism, the big women's strikes broke out in Poland after the law and justice tightened the abortion law, so attacked women's rights. And in my home city, there were big protests out of nowhere. There were like thousands and thousands of people on the street. And for me, that was like that was a very formative moment, because I realized like, oh my God, like even here, even in a place that I would never think, you know, can grow like a political resistance, that political resistance is emerging. And so I wanted to be part of it. And that was my beginning, like a proper, like, you know, being blessed into the movements. And I stayed ever since, you know, because... And so for me, like heading into 2023, we were exhausted, tired, hopeless, but also, you know, we were so scared and aware that any more of this, like, might really completely define our lives.
Sorry für die kurze Unterbrechung. Du hörst den Was tun Podcast und wir senden unsere Gespräche mit Aktivistinnen und Aktivisten einmal im Monat werbefrei und unabhängig. Das können wir wegen den vielen Fördermitgliedern, die Was tun und Dissens im Doppelpack unterstützen. Wenn du schon dabei bist, ganz herzlichen Dank. Wenn noch nicht, dann kannst du unten auf den Link klicken und Was tun und Dissens im Doppelpack unterstützen. Los geht's ab 3 €. Danke und jetzt viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
And so that sense of like, we just have to do everything to stop it, to prevent this. That was what kind of like guided me into the election year back then.
Yeah, that's really interesting insights already. I mean, in Germany right now, the situation is that in the local elections coming up in September, and there might be an absolute majority on the like local level for the German far-right party, the AfD. You having lived under like authoritarian far-right rule, can you talk a little bit more about how activism on the left works when the right is in government?
Well, it's never boring, that for sure. You always have plenty of work to do. But to be fair, like, we have this comparison right now, yeah? Like, we have Donald Tusk, who was, you know, supposedly an alternative to all injustice and think that, like, we have the better guys in office. I think, looking back, activism under law and justice, under the right-wing government, was much more mobilizing than it is these days, which is, you know, it's very tricky because, you know, at the same time back then, we knew we had all of these like inhumane policies being implemented, but there was a sense of resistance and there was a sense of movement and there was a fire that was definitely like coming out of people, especially among progressives and basically people who, you know, have this energy and determination to bring change to the world and bring justice to the world. But, you know, it was a reality of many restrictions and of fear because public media were completely overtook. There was very little conversations with the government officials. They would very, very rarely organize consultations around bills. Bills would be processed, you know, sometimes within a day. For example, a bill would be introduced, the next day it would be voted on, the next day it would go to the Senate and then go to the president, and suddenly, you know, it's in power. And so there was very little chances for us to be part of the democratic process. There was obviously like a huge corruption going on and a lot of just like plain money, like taking from like the public sources to party officials. And there was a lot of surveillance. Like, it was under law and justice that they introduced Pegasus, which was a system of essentially like tapping the phones and communication of people, organizations that were, you know, not in line with the government. And I think that the worst thing was that we were never able to know how far these guys would go, you know, just when we thought that like, oh, it cannot get any worse, they would show us that it can't get much worse. But people were mobilized, certainly. Right now, like since 3 years of having Donald Tusk in office, like what I'm saying is that it feels like we're swallowed by this tasteless pudding because things aren't moving forward. Things aren't also like terribly collapsing. But we are just stuck, and it feels wrong. But the people do not protest now. They are either frustrated and hopeless and without motivation, or they feel like things are not bad enough for them to actually take to the streets.
You talked a little bit about how it's easier to mobilize against a very strong opponent like the far right. In movement politics, often there is somehow like this mobilization paradox almost, where it's like the less likely it is that something can be won by our movements, the easier it is to get the people on the streets to protest. When you talk about this time under law and justice now, so under the far-right government, apart from successfully mobilizing people, do you have any chance to win some issues, or was it just to prevent the worst?
Certainly there were things that would move forward. For example, when you look at the years in which there was a boom on solar energy, it was actually during law and justice because people felt like there was a lot of middle class and upper class people in Poland feeling like the government is senselessly blocking the development of this like future clean energy. So we're going to invest it in it itself. And so like a lot of that transition happened then. There was also a lot of wins for the environmental movement. For example, the policy of like the cleaner policy in many Polish cities that have been highly polluted. That was like, it was under the law and justice government that these very strong policies were introduced by the government. And, you know, you have to remember that with law and justice, it is important to understand, because people get our right wing wrong very often. traditional right wing in Poland, so law and justice, which right now is in a very different state. So, but back then, these weren't like the Donald Trump, like pro-business politicians. They were a blend of like social economics plus hyper-nationalistic, ultra-Christian, anti-democratic politics, which is a weird blend. But in a way, the reason why I'm bringing this up is because we very often, and I've seen it with many, you know, many progressive people abroad also, that like, we do not understand the psychology that leads people to vote for parties like that. The way Law and Justice came into power in 2015 was mainly on their economic platform and mainly on this whole agenda of seeing the citizens that the liberal elites were ignoring for decades. In Poland, when we abolished the communist regime in the 90s, that revolution that the workers led, it was overtaken by a lot of business and a lot of like neoliberal elites and corporate interests. And we've had, you know, the shock doctrine in the 90s, hyper-capitalism being introduced here. And many people, we're talking like billions of people losing their workplaces, suddenly living in a much more impoverished state than they were under communism. And most importantly, a lot of like working class people who after they've led the country to such a big change, suddenly they were turned by like this new supposedly democratic elite. They were being told that like, no, you are lazy, you don't mean anything to the state, just sit silent and like scramble for basic living. And for many years, Polish politics would just sort of like not talk about this, but the economic inequalities and that political just frustration, hopelessness, it stayed with people. And so what Law and Justice did was that they tapped into these communities. So usually people from rural areas, people from smaller cities and towns, people are of lower income, like they just realized that they want to go for that electorate. And the way they did it was, among other things, by introducing the so-called 500 plus policy, which was a way to just give like something like 120 euros per month to families with more than one children. And so, you know, like, obviously it was a mix of also like nationalistic concepts, but basically it was like an anti-establishment party at the time. They would bash on like the rich, white teeth politicians from Warsaw because they were coming from like the margins, right? Even though it was a story that they made up, but it was a successful story. And I think what we as progressives, I feel like, obviously, it's super valid to talk about like how bad the far right is and the right wing and how dangerous it is to live under it. But in order for us to truly meet the moment we're in, we have to understand that why people go to them. And also, why is that to many people, to many working class people, it is the far right that is the only option that seems to see them. Why is it that it is only these people that seem to really connect with those who lead very often like lives of full of daily struggles? Because that is not the problem, isn't the far right itself. The problem is like the political mainstream that seems to be detached from ordinary citizens.
Yeah, I think there's a common heritage, at least in the east of Germany, where the AfD is also especially strong. That the people are very much demoralized by the early years of the transition from the GDR to the Bundesrepublik. That they were hoping for democratic rights, for freedoms, but what they got was, in the first place, at least poverty and neoliberalism. Which then leads to this right-wing backlash that we are seeing right now. And I also think it's really important to understand the hardships that these right-wing successes build on somehow, and then that they exploit, even though they don't really offer any good alternative for those people.
Eventually, we see that like the minute they are in office, like so much of these promises are just completely forgotten about. But then, you know, when I try to sort of like imagine myself in a situation like this, if the political like scene is not talking to me, is not offering anything to me, and I'm not getting anything, and I seem to not be getting anything out of politics, then at least I will get someone who emotionally relates to how I'm feeling. Yeah. So I'll get these emotions, that sort of like therapy side of things. I will get that, this public therapy. You know, it materially my life may worsen, but at least I'll feel like someone's seeing me. And that's a huge thing in a world that is just, you know, collapsing, for there to be politicians who see you. Like, even for me, you know, like when I look to some great progressive politicians, when I feel like, oh, they are there and they like really relate with what I'm doing, I feel good. And I guess we just need to really understand deeply like the psychology behind that, because many people come in to like, you know, they approach far right voters with like trying to like reform them and like save them from the far right. Like, come on, like these people don't need saving. They need to be heard.
Yeah. You were also involved in the mobilizations against the next far-right victory in 2023. You were part of the movements that mobilized people so effectively that the Law and Justice Party, yeah, the far-right government in Poland couldn't govern for another term, and that they were replaced by a more liberal coalition led by Donald Tusk. Could you talk a little bit more about different strategies that led to the defeat of the far right in 2023?
For us, the key was really listening to people and like just like watching closely like what the vibes are out there. And second, like innovation and being super dynamic and very flexible with all the sort of ideas and things that we allowed ourselves to do. At the beginning of the year, actually, that was, for me, that was the interesting bit, is that around March 2023, elections were scheduled for October. In March 2023, there was a research published, a small research, where they said that they were basically checking the willingness of different voting groups to go vote. We could read from that women between 18 and 35, like more than half of them, did not plan to vote. Many people ignored this statistic, but for me, when I saw this post, I remember to this day, like, I was shocked, because like, what do you mean, in a country that has seen one of Europe's biggest women protests in the past like years, like, what do you mean, like half of us, half of my group is just completely given up? But then when I gave it a second turn, I was like, no, I mean, that totally makes sense. If I ask myself, how do I feel about voting? I do not want to have anything in common with that, because I'm just hopeless. I'm angry, but I'm also tired. Like, take it all away from me. But obviously, like, for me, it was clear, like, we cannot just let it pass, you know, we cannot just let it like slip our attention. And so we figured, like, okay, so if that's the case, then we're going to focus on us, on young people and on women, because this is who we are. This is what the Sunrise, which is the movement that I'm part of, this is us, this is who we are. And so the way we want to approach this election work is that, in a reality where the government obviously is not on our side, and in a reality where like the opposition leaders are basically competing for who's the bigger macho, like, what we're going to do is we're going to like take back our power and take back the public attention on us, on real people, on our needs, on our struggles, on our frustrations. Obviously, we had no instructions on how to do it. We had no clue, like no clue. We learned from Hungarian elections, the 2022 elections, that, you know, putting all of our hopes and energies into like rallying behind one opposition leader is just not good, because then like the rest of the society is just sort of, you know, put to the side. And so we decided to like basically like make young people and make women the decisive players of the elections. And we did it in many different ways. Like, I remember we would do as with our like teenage activists and our like student activists, we would, bump into, like, we would go to different, political rallies and candidate meetings, and we would either, like, confront the politicians or disrupt these events to just bring the attention to us. We would also go to, like, music festivals and, like, cultural events to train people in voting, and we would bring this, like, big ballot box, and we would, like, hand people, like, fake election cards to, like, make them, like, choose which issues they were most concerned with. We would do a lot of content online, just basically like putting our voice out there. Also, we would go, we would do fun things, you know? And that was also what we said to us, like at the beginning of summer, we were like, it seems like we're not going to make it. And it seems like the third term of Law and Justice is secured. But like for these final months before the elections, let's just like delusionally assume that we're gonna make it and let's have as much fun as we can in the process. And so, for example, remember we decided in the summer to do a silent disco in front of our parliament, and that was the first ever party like this, and so many people came, and we just basically organized a huge party, you know, in front of our parliamentary offices, and it felt great. It felt awesome. Because, you know, and it, you know, it wasn't like a serious protest for social justice, da-da-da, none of these things. But all of a sudden, we just showed to the people that politics, the way we are defining it, it can have a different face. And we shouldn't turn away from it. Like, we can have fun. We can, like, you know, joke around and do it, like, in a very unserious Gen Z way. But let's just do it. Let's be part of this.
Du hörst den Was tun Podcast. Valentin spricht mit Dominika Lasota aus Polen darüber, wie sie die Peace-Partei, die Law and Justice-Partei, wieder losgeworden sind und was wir als Aktivistinnen aus den Kämpfen gegen rechte Regierung lernen können. Wenn du Menschen kennst, die sich auch für dieses Thema interessieren, dann klick doch jetzt auf den Teilen-Link in deinem Podcatcher und schick ihn die Folge rüber. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
And then towards closer to the elections, we decided like for the final bit, we're going to do an election video, because we were like, if all these political candidates can have their election videos, we want to have one of ours. And so, but the election video we did was, we just highlighted different faces of the law and justice, the right-wing reality, and how it hits minority groups and women and young people, and how they are told to be silent by the politicians, and how politicians would insult us on a daily basis. And then towards the end of this video, people change like their finger from like a silent finger to the middle finger. So they turn their hand and they show the middle finger to the authorities. And that one's just, people went crazy about it. It was like, it was the most watched electoral video of all time. We uploaded it online to Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, but then it just went viral, and like cinemas took it up, influencers took it up, media took it up. Like the non-government, like the non-public TV would play this video like for the whole like week before the elections. And, you know, so crazy things happened to it. And, you know, that's not for me to say that, like, yeah, go and do this big electoral video that's going to win you the elections. Because for us, it was also like some strategic thinking, but also a lot of luck. But, you know, I think like I still stand by the kind of approach we had, like bringing back, sort of like taking back the attention to us, from them to us, like making the elections about us, not about the parties, the politicians, because, you know, as long as we play their game, they're going to win. And we have to like just set the rules.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. We should definitely also link the video in the show notes. The weird thing, in a way, is you did have a lot of success with your approaches. Also feel that you didn't get what you mobilized for. So you wrote this piece for Frontline Notes arguing that getting rid of the far right wasn't actually the hardest part in your fight against law and justice, but more the liberals that came afterwards. So after the defeat of the far right, for people who are not that familiar with Polish politics, a new president came into office, Donald Tusk, who was somehow in the European press coverage seen as the democratic warrior for Poland who can like took back the power from the far right, redemocratizing Poland. Yeah, you paint a very skeptical picture of this victory and especially of what came after this victory. Can you talk a little bit more about how the situation has changed after the victory of Donald Tusk and why you are so frustrated with the liberals who came after Law and Justice?
Yeah, for sure. To clarify, Donald Tusk became our prime minister, not the president. And that is key because the Law and Justice was still holding the presidential office, because we have such a system that there is the government and Donald Tusk became the prime minister. And that's like the main executive organ. But then the president signs all the bills. And once he signs the bills, or she, but we've never had a she, once he signs the bills or vetoes them, that's when they either become law or they are not law anymore, or, you know, they just disappear from the picture. When Donald Tusk came into power and they formed this coalition, multi-party coalition, they were still having that blockade in the face of President Duda, so the Law and Justice president. I think we always knew that the right wing will have their president and that he's going to be obstructing and that they're going to be fighting and trying their best for this governing coalition to not succeed. So that was like the blockade that we were aware of, that, you know, the fight is not going to end. But I think what we were not expecting, and I was definitely not expecting this, is how quickly the Donald Tusk and that governing, that new governing coalition would completely turn on the things that they were promising us in the elections. You know, in the electoral campaign, they were painting a picture of, you know, the democratic alternative that stands on the side of the people. And very early on into entering their offices, they would start to replicate the policies that Law and Justice was doing, either prolonging the policies, behaving in a similar style, or, you know, just sort of one piece by piece, dismantling our hopes for this transformative change that we voted for. The reason why I wrote that they were, that was the harder bit, is because they seemed like the better guys. For a long time, like the people who became ministers, they were our, like, wouldn't say like friends, but they were in some way our allies. Like they would let us into the parliament and they would fight for us to be able to go to all of these commissions. Like they would speak with us. They would sort of like carry the message of different social movements. Like they would show us that they're on our side. And once they got into those big offices, it was like they just completely forgot who they were before. The politics changed its aesthetic, but it didn't change its content. You know, we would still get politics that stands on the side of big businesses, not on the side of the workers. We would still end up with like never-ending debates on how we cannot change the reproductive law and we cannot make it like align it with the international health standards, that we have to keep this conservative church like influenced policy. Like piece by piece, we would just hear these new government repeating the things, like saying, we would hear all of those right-wingers speak for years. And at the beginning, it was like on a cognitive level, like we just did not know what to do. We were completely lost and confused. And I think, to be honest, like the big strategic mistake is that we really were not prepared for them to win. Like it just sort of like came as a surprise to us that they won. We didn't have, as a civil society, as organizations, like we didn't have a list of like, we want this reform and that reform and this reform. Like these three or five things, they need to be like your common ground, no matter the different like coalition parties differences, like these things you deliver. We didn't know that because for so long, our goal was just to like fight against Law and Justice, like prevent them from continuing, fight against, but we didn't know what we were fighting for. And that bit us back, really. And that turned out to ended up with us just sitting sort of like powerlessly and seeing this new coalition get lost and confused and get stuck. And we didn't really know what we wanted from them. And yeah, and that was, I think that we that is our mistake. We were not ready for the victory. And so now, you know, it's years later, we are a year ahead of the next parliamentary elections. And to be honest, like the way, like, so we've done so much work ever since, so much work in like actually like understanding what are our priorities. And so, you know, we know what we want to fight and we know what we want to achieve. Yeah, but party politics, we changed our approach to it so much ever since.
Yeah, I think that's a very common strategic dilemma when working with parties as social movements. On some way, you want the good guys in office, right? You want you rather want Donald Tusk in office than Kaczynski and his Law and Order party. And once you have the good guys in office or the better guys in office, you find yourself in this weird place where you, on one hand, you don't want to criticize the good guys too much because otherwise people see them too critically and they lose support. And that means strengthening the right wing again. On the other hand, if you just sit still and don't do anything, you get the same politics repackaged with different aesthetics. So somehow you are in this like blackmailing trap where whatever you do, the bad thing comes out in the end. And I think it's interesting how you try to reposition yourself now towards focusing more on specific issues, ignoring the party politics side about it a little bit. Do I understand correctly? Or how would you describe your approach for the next elections?
I think it's fair to say that we just stopped caring for whether our critique and our protests are a problem to this governing coalition. Because for me, the problem here and the issue here is not that we're going to criticize them. It's the fact that, you know, they are playing the game of the right wing. If there is something that's going to make the right wing come back into government, it's the fact that this governing coalition has turned the political mainstream, or maybe not turned, but like it has solidified the political mainstream to be right wing mainstream. Because they repeat the right-wingers' policies, they speak the way right-wingers do, and they just play their game. So we're not the issue, and we're not going to be pushed into this like position where, you know, we would be blackmailed by those in power. Like, no, like at the end of the day, we will fight for justice no matter who is in the office. And we definitely fight for issues and for very concrete stuff these days. Like in 2024, so in the year after the election here, we started building what's called Plan for Generations. And basically, it was our attempt to answer as activists, as like Gen Z and millennials that we are in the Sunrise, we try to answer the question of like, what's the country that we really want to live in? Like what kind of Poland we want to build our futures in. And so we assembled that and we released that. And ever since, we're just basically, you know, building the power of our movement, recruiting new people, training new people. We're building alliances with other movements. And essentially, we're just trying to build this new political ecosystem that's going to be about justice, that's going to be about decent living for all, and that's going to be about like mutual solidarity. If the party politicians will want to be part of it, great. But if not, then we're just still going to do our job and still going to lead this struggle and this work the way we want it. And so approach and strategy for next year's elections is, for me in my head, it's still a bit unclear. But I think one thing that we learned is that we need to have it very clear what is it that we're trying to win in Poland, you know, what we're trying to build here. Not what party we want to push to win, It's all about like what kind of solutions we want to deliver our people, what kind of concrete material change we want to make sure that people can see and experience. That's the questions. I'm not interested in the social polls right now and what Donald Tusk thinks and what he doesn't think.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting and promising. In the east of Germany, especially also the Länder, where we have the local elections coming up, we already see now how different parties are forming more and more incoherent coalitions just to prevent the AfD from taking power. This is a little bit worrying, I think. On one hand, you can understand they want to prevent majority from the AfD, but talking about these concrete issues and material wins, this completely gets out of sight when you just focus on getting together the numbers, right? Because then with a coalition from conservatives to left, you will not find a program that can actually tackle the problems that lead people to voting for the AfD.
Seeing how it played out in Poland, you know, and I'm not fully confident on that. So it's just me and I have loose thoughts around it. But I do feel like the answer to the rise of the far right lays in bold, courageous, dynamic, people-centered progressive movements, political movements. It doesn't lay in these like flaky coalitions that are supposed to be there for, you know, to save us from like the bigger threat of the far right. Like for me, like constantly live in this, just in this toxic political system that favors like the big businesses, the powerful, the rich, and not ordinary citizens. And so we need coalitions to counter this, but coalitions that are going to be like rooted in this like courageous politics, care-oriented politics, solidarity politics, and not just momentary unions to avoid what disrupting of this game. Like, yeah, no, I feel like this game needs to be disrupted, just not by fascist people, but we have to disrupt it.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe just as a last question, if you were to flesh out 1 to 3 lessons learned that you could give as advice to people trying to counter the far right in Germany now, what would be your advice?
Well, first of all, you know, the far right might win, but the planet will not stop existing, you know, like the world will not stop. We're going to wake up again, and there is going to be plenty of work to do that next day. And so I would just, I know it is scary, but in a way, like they want us to be scared. And so our approach was to just not give it to them. Our approach was to counter what they were doing with fierceness, with power, with hope, also with joy, you know, with our vibe, like the Slavic fire. Like that was our approach. So just, you know, try to not give in to the fear. There is always going to be work. And I would say that, you know, we live in times that just call for us to shake up the systems that we live in. For the far righters, they shake these systems in obviously in a very toxic way, but the answer to it should be us shaking this reality in our way, in this bold, courageous way that's going to fiercely fight for justice for people and fiercely fight for the things that we believe are the most most important. So don't be scared, be playful, be joyful, experiment, have fun, because you know it might be that the world will be burning, but at least like you know that you've given it your best and that you've protected your hearts and conscience, try to show to the people that there is a better reality to strive for. So yeah, maybe those are this. Be prepared for a potential victory. Because if you aren't prepared, if you assume that you might win, but actually you don't, you won't win, then if you win, you're screwed. So don't be screwed, please.
Thanks so much, Dominika. Thanks for coming on the show and talk about the Polish experience of defeating the far right and what comes after it.
Thank you. And if we can be of any support we are there. You know, we've lived through this government. We're still here. We're not moving anywhere. So feel free to reach out.
So, da sind wir wieder und wie vor der Podcast-Pause auch schon sitzen Inken und ich jetzt auch bei der Miniserie wieder zusammen und sammeln die losen Enden ein. Ich würde jetzt, Inken, dich einfach mal fragen, was fandest du denn besonders interessant jetzt bei dem Interview mit Dominika? Was können wir auch für den Kampf gegen die AfD vielleicht aus ihrem Aktivismus und ja und den Kampagnen, über die sie erzählt hat, lernen?
Das Erste, was mir aufgefallen ist, war, dass Sie in der Kampagne, die Sie vor der Wahl gemacht haben, auf so eine sehr spezifische Gruppe abgezielt haben, zu der Dominika auch selber gehört hat. Und dass Sie halt nicht gesagt haben, einfach wir versuchen, NichtwählerInnen zu erreichen. Ich habe das Gefühl, so ist das sonst oft oder auch in Deutschland oft, dass man dann sagt, ah, es gibt hier diesen großen Block an Leuten, die gehen gar nicht wählen und die versuchen wir jetzt zu erreichen. Aber das sind natürlich sehr unterschiedliche Leute aus unterschiedlichen Altersgruppen, unterschiedlichem Geschlecht, aus unterschiedlichen Gründen. Und dass Dominika da entschieden hat, wir gehen wirklich auf Frauen zwischen 18 und 25, die planen, nicht wählen zu gehen. Das ist eine Gruppe, aus der kommt sie auch selbst, die versteht sie deswegen ganz gut und auf die zielen sie ab mit der Kampagne. Und das hat ja offensichtlich auch ganz gut funktioniert und das fand ich den ersten Take, den ich mitnehmen würde, sozusagen, wenn man vor Wahlen Kampagnen macht, dann wirklich sozusagen eine möglichst konkrete Gruppe rauszugreifen, die man gut kennt und die man deswegen auch gut erreichen kann.
Könnte man vielleicht auch sagen, dass es ein Stück weit auch so ein Organizing aus einer betroffenen Perspektive heraus war?
Ja, auf eine Art und Weise ja schon. Ich meine, also sie ist ja als junge Frau selbst betroffen von der Regierung der Peace-Partei in Polen und hat das ja auch erzählt, dass sie einfach sozusagen jeden Tag kamen irgendwelche Meldungen von Rechten, die beschnitten wurden. Es gab ja, haben wir ja mal in einer Folge vor relativ langer Zeit auch mit einer Aktivistin aus Polen gesprochen, wo es um Schwangerschaftsabbruch ging, die dann angefangen haben, Schwangerschaftsabbrüche selbst zu organisieren, weil das halt auch ein Recht war, was von der Peace-Regierung eingeschränkt wurde. Und da ist man natürlich als junge Frau direkt betroffen und von daher würde ich sagen, ja, das ist auf jeden Fall auch Organizing aus einer eigenen betroffenen Perspektive, aber halt ein bisschen auch mit einer größeren Vision. Jetzt sozusagen nicht nur um die eigene Situation zu verbessern, sondern dann ja wirklich auch um einen größeren politischen Wandel herbeizuführen.
Ich fand zu dem Punkt Organisierung von Betroffenen und eben auch vor allem dieser Fokus auf junge Frauen, die eben überproportional vor der Wahl geplant hatten, ihre Stimme nicht abzugeben. Da fand ich nochmal interessant das Video, von dem Dominika erzählt hat. Sie hatte ja schon ganz kurz ein bisschen darüber gesprochen, was da zu sehen ist. Ich versuche es nochmal so ein bisschen zusammenzufassen, damit man sich das gut vorstellen kann. Würde ich euch aber auf jeden Fall auch empfehlen, das Video über den Link in den Shownotes nochmal selber anzuschauen. Man sieht in dem Video so unterschiedliche Alltagssituationen. Leute, die in der Küche stehen, die bügeln, die irgendwelche Sachen machen, wie wir sie halt jeden Tag alle tun. Und im Hintergrund laufen so Fetzen auf Polnisch von Peace-Politikern, die irgendwie ja letztendlich gegen diese Gruppen hetzen und versuchen, die irgendwie weiter zu marginalisieren. Und im weiteren Verlauf des Videos sieht man dann die Frauen, wie sie alle ihren Finger an den Mund halten, so als würde man jemandem bedeuten, dass sie ruhig sein sollen, also dieses klassische Psst-Zeichen. Zum Ende hin drehen sie dann ihre Hand und man sieht eben, dass das gar nicht der Zeigefinger ist, den sie da vor dem Mund haben, sondern eben der Mittelfinger, also dass sie eigentlich kollektiv, so eine große Gruppe an Frauen, dass sie kollektiv der Law and Justice Partei eben den Mittelfinger zeigen und sagen, so nicht mehr, wir wählen jemand anders. Und ich finde, das ist irgendwie so ein ganz guter, ja, Videoebene nochmal so ein ganz gutes Beispiel dafür, wie man so aus so einer Position der Marginalisierung heraus ein Stück weit den Schalter umlegt in so eine Empowerment-Botschaft. Oder wie würdest du das sehen, denken?
Ja, nee, das finde ich auch. Sozusagen auch zu zeigen, dass man einfach abgefuckt ist davon und da so ein deutliches Signal zu senden. Das finde ich auch, also fand ich sehr kraftvoll und auch echt ein cooles Video. Was ich dabei noch interessant fand, und das ist ja was Dominika auch gesagt hat, dass sie wirklich in dieser Kampagne auf die Leute fokussiert haben, die diese Politik betrifft und nicht so sehr auf die Peace-Partei als Schreckgespenst. Und das fand ich irgendwie interessant, weil ich das Gefühl habe, dass wir dazu oft neigen und auch hier dazu neigen, dann zu sagen, die AfD ist rassistisch, die AfD ist sexistisch.
Zurzeit sieht man die Fresse von Maximilian Krah.
Genau, oder von Björn Höcke. Da wird ganz viel über diese Männer geredet, die gefährlich sind. Und das stimmt natürlich, dass es Männer sind, die gefährlich sind. Aber für die Leute, die man erreichen möchte, ist es viel kraftvoller, wenn man die zeigt und die auch zeigt in einer empowerten Situation. Und sozusagen vor allem einfach die Menschen, mit denen man sprechen will und über die man spricht, ins Zentrum auch der Videobotschaften oder sozusagen auch dieser des Bildmaterials und der Messages zu stellen. Und das fand ich echt cool und voll kraftvoll. Und es hat ja offensichtlich auch gut funktioniert.
Ja, vielleicht ist das jetzt der richtige Zeitpunkt in der Nachbesprechung, um nochmal so ein bisschen weiterzugehen. Dominika hat ja gesagt, irgendwie waren sie mega erfolgreich mit ihrer Kampagne. Das Video ist viral gegangen, die Law and Justice Partei wurde abgewählt und so weiter. Aber irgendwie danach kam das Ganze so ein bisschen ins Stocken. Und jetzt sind sie eben auch total unglücklich mit der Regierung, die jetzt danach kommt, mit dem Regierungsbündnis rund um Donald Tusk. Was waren denn da so Sachen für dich, wo du sagst, daraus kann man vielleicht was mitnehmen, das kann man vielleicht übersetzen auf den deutschen Kontext?
Ja, halt, also das, was sie auch selbst gesagt hat, nicht nur bis zur Wahl planen, sondern auch damit rechnen, dass man tatsächlich gewinnen könnte und sich überlegen, was dann die Sachen sind, die man wirklich umgesetzt haben will. Also ich musste da auch so ein bisschen ganz anderes Szenario auf eine Art und Weise, aber ich musste trotzdem ein bisschen dran denken, wie es mir zumindest ging, nachdem die Ampelregierung an die Regierung gekommen ist, weil ich da auch den Eindruck hatte oder selbst auch so erlebt habe, dass da ganz, ganz viel Campaigning und ganz viel Kraft vorher reingesteckt wurde, halt diese Wechselstimmung in Deutschland zu erzeugen, nicht mehr die CDU sozusagen, sondern eine SPD-geführte Regierung. Es muss nach den ganzen Merkel-Jahren endlich mal was losgehen, total viele Projekte stoppen, so diese Wechselstimmung herzustellen. Und dann kam die Ampel an die Macht und es gab irgendwie keinen organisierten Block mehr, der da drin noch ein Gewicht sozusagen für progressive Politik darstellen konnte. Und das hat es auf eine Art und Weise der FDP krass einfach gemacht und der SPD auch sehr leicht gemacht, in diese konservative Richtung umzufallen zu oft. Und ja, sozusagen damit zu rechnen, dass man tatsächlich gewinnen könnte, wenn man Kampagnen macht und wenn man auf einen Regierungswechsel setzt und sich dann auch schon vorher zu überlegen, was die Must-Haves sind, die man wirklich dann selber umsetzen will. Das ist, glaube ich, auch aus Bewegungsperspektive halt ein Takeaway.
Jetzt für die Wahlen im Osten, die Wahl in Sachsen-Anhalt und aber auch in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, wenn man jetzt sehr optimistisch ist, dann könnte man da ja sagen, okay, vielleicht kommt es da ja zu einem ähnlichen Szenario. Also, dass irgendeine Riesenkoalition von Konservativen bis Linken irgendwie noch die AfD verhindert, vielleicht zumindest in einem Bundesland, wenn nicht in beiden. Und das wäre ja dann eigentlich wahrscheinlich ein bisschen ähnliches Szenario, wie das, über das Dominika gesprochen hat. Da gibt es ja dann häufig eben dieses Dilemma, dass gesagt wird, wenn ihr uns jetzt kritisiert, wenn ihr uns, bessere Regierung, die The Better Guys, sagt sie es ja in dem Interview, jetzt für unsere Politik kritisiert, dann zahlt das am Ende auf das Konto der Rechten ein, ne? Also wenn ihr versucht, irgendwie eure Frustration dann auf die Straße zu tragen, dann führt das vor allem dazu, dass die Leute, die vielleicht diese Riesenkoalition dann ins Amt gehievt haben, so frustriert sind, dass sie ja bei der nächsten Wahl vielleicht anders wählen würden und dann diese Mehrheiten nicht mehr so zustande kommen, die AfD dadurch noch leichter an die Macht käme. Ja, wie gehst du denn raus in Bezug auf dieses Dilemma? Also hat das dich überzeugt, was sie da sagt? Wie würdest du damit umgehen, jetzt auch konkret im deutschen Kontext? Ein Stück weit würde ich sagen, ist ja Dominikas Ansatz auch einfach zu sagen, vielleicht sogar ein bisschen Scheuklappen aufzusetzen und zu sagen, wir als Bewegung für unsere Themen, wir denken nicht immer von den Konsequenzen aus und übernehmen praktisch Verantwortung, was dann auf Ebene der Parteien irgendwie passieren könnte, welche Koalition und so weiter. Aber ja, irgendwie so, ich habe auch so einen Anteil in mir, der sagt, macht man sich dann damit nicht vielleicht einerseits zu einfach und ist es andererseits vielleicht auch brandgefährlich, das so auszuklammern. Wie schaust du da drauf, Inken?
Ja, ich meine, es ist ja nun mal Kennzeichen von einem Dilemma, dass man keinen guten Weg rausfindet. Und das gilt halt einfach auch in diesem Fall. Also man hat auf jeden Fall einfach diese Gefahren auf beiden Seiten, wenn man sozusagen nur in große Koalitionen geht und dann keine eigenen Politiken mehr umsetzen kann, dann fragen sich die Leute, warum sie einen gewählt haben. Zu Recht ja irgendwie auch. Und wenn man dann gleichzeitig in so einer großen Koalition ist und nur die eigenen Interessen verfolgt, dann bricht halt die Koalition auseinander und die extremen Kräfte auf der rechten Seite können halt im Zweifelsfall daraus Gewinn schlagen. Ich glaube, was ich mitnehmen würde, ist, konkrete Themenpolitik trotzdem weiter zu verfolgen. Mhm. Also weder sozusagen immer dieses Narrativ zu fahren, die große Koalition muss halten oder die ganz große Koalition muss halten, weil das ist einfach im Zweifelsfall den Leuten irgendwie egal. Die wollen wissen, ob es ihnen gerade gut oder schlecht geht und ob ihre Inhalte irgendwie vorkommen. Und da würde ich, glaube ich, einfach gucken, was dann die Politiken, die die Menschen vor Ort dann in Sachsen-Anhalt oder in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern konkret bewegen und sich dafür halt einzusetzen. Und jetzt halt natürlich auch nicht random irgendwas, sondern die Sachen, die einen auch selber wirklich interessieren.
Und es gibt ja jetzt aber auch immer wieder diese taktisch wählen Ansätze. Vor der Wahl ist es ja noch. Da mischt man sich ja auch ganz schön doll ein auf in diesem Terrain der Parteipolitik. Ist das was, wo du sagst, ja, aber das ist trotzdem wichtig, das sollte man auch gerade als Bewegung vielleicht mit unterstützen? Oder würdest du sagen, das ist auch was, das überlässt man den Parteien, das müssen die selber unter sich auskungeln oder so, wo die es hinkriegen, wo sie es nicht hinkriegen, aber das ist nicht was für uns als AktivistInnen, wo wir jetzt irgendwie uns da groß einmischen, weil am Ende hört auf uns sonst dann auch am Ende niemand mehr und dann wollen wir uns da auch nicht, ja, in Anführungsstrichen, die Hände schmutzig machen.
Also wir haben ja schon mal länger auch in einer anderen Folge drüber gesprochen. Meine Haltung ist dazu immer noch, dass man dazu natürlich eine Position haben kann und sollte, weil im Zweifelsfall, also wenn man sich nicht einmischt, dann überlässt man es halt Parteien und leider hat man es auch schon oft genug gesehen, dass die es einfach nicht auf die Reihe kriegen, sich da zu einigen und sozusagen sinnvolle Wahlempfehlungen auszusprechen. Von daher würde ich schon sagen, dass man sich da auch als Bewegung einmischen kann. Und die Frage ist ja auch als Bewegung, was man halt für Forderungen vorab stellen kann, bevor man KandidatInnen unterstützt. Also da gibt es ja sozusagen auch dieses altbewährte Mittel der KandidatInnen-Checks, dass man halt die einfach mal fragt, so wie stehen sie denn zu den eigenen Themen und davon dann auch eine Unterstützung im Zweifelsfall abhängig macht. Aber jetzt mal umgedreht, Valentin, was hast du denn noch mitgenommen?
Also ich kann dem, was du jetzt gesagt hast, größtenteils auf jeden Fall total zustimmen. Für mich war irgendwie ganz am Ende nochmal dieser Schlusspunkt im Gespräch wichtig, wo Dominika sagt, die Welt endet nicht mit einer rechten Regierung. Mhm. Also auch am nächsten Morgen wachst du auf, auch am nächsten Morgen musst du irgendwie weiter Sachen machen. Und wenn du aktiv bleiben willst, dann kannst du auch aktiv bleiben unter einer rechten Regierung. Zum Teil musst du eben nochmal ein bisschen Strategien anpassen, die Ebenen ändern, auf die du dich fokussierst. Jetzt mal angenommen, die AfD würde nach den Landtagswahlen in einem dieser Bundesländer eben die Regierung stellen. Da hat man natürlich immer noch einzelne Städte, die vielleicht trotzdem noch Hochburgen sind, wo noch mehr geht, wo die Leute noch progressiver sind, dann ist die Frage, fokussiert man sich da mehr drauf oder diese ganzen Sachen, also einfach so auch da wieder, ne, nicht nur bis zur Wahl denken und dann gewinnt man entweder und muss darauf vorbereitet sein oder die Welt ist zu Ende und man fällt über die Klippe, sondern dann gibt's weiterhin viel zu tun. Das war für mich irgendwie vorher nochmal so, so ein großes Learning.
Ja, vielleicht noch einen letzten Punkt, den ich, glaube ich, noch unterbringen würde, ist, dass ich interessant fand, dass was sie für eine Art von Campaigning schon vorher, aber auch nach der Wahl irgendwie vorgeschlagen hat und dass sie so stark gemacht hat, dass Rechte halt mit Angst gewinnen und dass Progressive aber eher mit Hoffnung und Freude gewinnen. Und dass sie auch sozusagen ja starke Fraktionsformate gesetzt hat, das hat sie auch Gen-Z-Politik genannt, stark auf Formate gesetzt haben, die irgendwie auch Spaß gemacht haben und cool waren. Da hat sie diesen Rave, von diesem Rave erzählt. Ich musste aber auch nochmal an unsere Folge vor sehr langer Zeit mit Sergej Popovic aus Serbien denken, der davon erzählt hat, wie sie damals in Serbien sozusagen als Demokratiebewegung gegen den Diktator gewonnen haben und da auch sehr stark gemacht hat, dass die sehr viel auf so Prankster-Politik gesetzt haben, also auf Politiken, die nicht sozusagen mit Aggression und Wut so sehr in eine Konfrontation gehen, sondern mit Humor und damit auch zum Teil diese autoritären Figuren lächerlich zu machen in Aktionsformen. Und da muss ich irgendwie nochmal dran denken, dass sozusagen da eigentlich gegen halt diese Angstmache und auch Aggressivität der Rechten auf unserer Seite doch dann eigentlich Humor und Freude und Lebensfreude, vielleicht das sind, was eher die Markenkerne linker Politik sein sollten und sie sich auch dann davon abheben können, mit denen man natürlich auch Leute wieder zurückgewinnen kann.
Cool, dann belassen wir es vielleicht erstmal dabei. Das war Folge 1 in unserer Miniserie Was tun, wenn die Rechten regieren? Freut euch schon mal auf Folge 2. Bis dahin, wenn es wieder heißt...
Was tun.
Das war der Was tun Podcast. Konzept und Redaktion Valentin Isen und Inken Beermann. Schnitt Anna Neu und Julian Schlumberger. Und die Musik kommt von Richard Waterman.